on today's episode of May the Record Reflect.
If you can't boil your idea down to one elevator ride, then the idea probably isn't going to sell, whether it's to a TV network or to a jury. And so if you're on an elevator and Steven Spielberg walks in, we should all be so lucky, and he says, so, Kate, what are you working on? Then if you're like, well, I'm kind of working on this show that, so it's based on a book, and already you've lost him, right? And so practice that elevator pitch. I would encourage everyone to digest lots of material and try it out on people. Rehearse it. So like you're always coming down to this compelling story. And if you can't do it in one elevator ride, you're probably not going to win that trial.
When I'm adapting a material, normally what I will start with is breaking down the events of the story into single sentences, as simple as I can make them, and putting them in order. And so then I have all my pieces and I can play with them as I like. I can really see the shape of it when I reduce everything down to the hero arrives or the monster attacks. It's very clear.
That was Kevin Newberry and Kate Douglas. And this is May the Record Reflect. Hi, welcome back. This is Marcy Mangan, hosting, as always, the monthly podcast for the National Institute for Trial Advocacy. My guests today are not lawyers. They don't even play lawyers on TV or on Broadway, which is actually where you're more likely to find them most of the time. Kevin Newberry is a theater, opera, and film director based in New York City. He has directed over 70 original productions at venues like the Kennedy Center, Carnegie Hall, the San Francisco Opera, the Santa Fe Opera, and the Wexford Festival in Ireland, among many others. You may have even caught his production of Leonard Bernstein's Mass on the award-winning series Great Performances on PBS. Kate Douglas is a theater artist, composer, and performer. Her latest work, The Ninth Hour, is a modern retelling of The Legend of Beowulf and opens in London this month. Her big project after that is The Survival of St. Joan, a Broadway rock opera that she and Kevin are collaborating on. It plucks Joan of Arc out of 15th century France and plops her down into a Catholic school in Buffalo in 1969, of course. So you must be wondering what on earth these two theater kids are doing here at NIDA. Well, they're fantastic storytellers, and helping jurors feel empathy and compassion for your client by telling their story is indeed one of the challenges of courtroom advocacy. I am thrilled to have Kevin and Kate here to talk about how to bring the magic of theater into your trial practice. Here's our interview. So I am so glad to have you both on the podcast to talk about storytelling. It is a really essential part of any case that actually goes to trial. And one thing that you both have decades of experience with is taking a story told in one medium, such as a book, for example, and flipping it or converting it for retelling in a different medium, such as, of course, a play or an opera. And to my way of thinking, trial lawyers are doing exactly the same thing, aren't they? They're taking an actual event that happened, which is one medium, and telling the story of what happened in a different medium to an audience of jurors. Kevin Newberry and Kate Douglas, let's break that down. Kevin, what should a story do?
We often say in the theater that a good story is both surprising and inevitable, and that it has a sense of suspense that builds throughout the evening. And then whatever the payoff is, feels like you've been leading towards it the whole time, but it still has a sense of surprise to it. And we often say, too, that everyone on the team has to be telling the same story. So, for instance, Kate and I have collaborated on a couple of music theater projects, and we always start by asking, what are the fundamental questions and themes that we want to explore with this piece. And that every meeting, every rehearsal, every conversation always comes back to that question. And the choices that we make working with a team of designers and actors and musicians all lead towards asking that one question, exploring that one theme, and hopefully creating a story that's both surprising and inevitable.
Yeah, to build off of that, I often think of that central question as your guiding star. So whenever you're lost in terms of what choices to make, as there are an infinite amount of creative choices one might make in a process, you can always look to your guiding star to answer the question of what is the most effective, compelling, dynamic way to speak to why you're doing this project now.
Yeah, that's a good way of thinking about it, as kind of a North Star. So how is a story helpful to trial lawyers in developing their case for trial?
Well, as Kevin will elaborate, storytelling is an essential part of what makes us human. It's an essential part of how we process information and make meaning, not just in dramatic or theatrical context, but throughout our lives. It's how we stitch together our identities, even, or how we really how we shape our lives. So the idea that storytelling would be siloed away from other aspects of our life and work, I think is a little bit reductive in that way.
Yeah, we really are natural born storytellers. I love to think about the evolution and revolutions in communication. So you think of us all sitting around the campfire and telling stories and writing those stories on the cave walls. And then you have the printing press. Like, what was a book? Imagine sending a book into the jungle or into a society or a culture. And like, what is this book? What is writing on a page? And then here we are in the middle of what I believe is the third and probably biggest evolution and revolution in storytelling, and that's the information age. And now we have access to any number of story, real news, fake news, gossip. Humans are particularly good at gossiping and telling stories and watching how those stories take shape and how they change. And those narratives define who we are as a culture. And I think that every trial has to have a fundamental story and a question and a theme that the attorney is exploring.
So it sounds like you think we are indeed all natural born storytellers, but a lot of us feel like, maybe not so much, but we are all creative. And so how do we unleash that beast? What kind of ideas do you have to throw out and offer to our listeners?
I love to look at formulas to start, even when I'm adapting a material, as we mentioned earlier. I sometimes look at structures like beginning and middle and end. That's a classic one. Or there are other ones you can look up if you Google something as simple of how to write a television show or how to write a television pitch. Those are really useful starting places. Sometimes if you don't know where to go, you can fill out formulas of all kinds to begin to shape your story. I definitely go there. When I'm adapting a material, normally what I will start with is breaking down the events of the story into single sentences, as simple as I can make them, and putting them in order. And so then I have all my pieces and I can play with them as I like. I can really see the shape of it when I reduce everything down to the hero arrives or the monster attacks. It's very clear.
There's a wonderful book by Christopher Booker called The Seven Basic Plots, Why We Tell Stories. And there are many other books and podcasts and articles that explore the similar structure. But his thesis is that humans tell the same stories over and over again, that we can fit every story model into one of the following. It's overcoming the monster, the rags to riches story, the quest, voyage and return, comedy, tragedy, rebirth, There's another theory that looks at, you know, the person versus the higher power, or a person versus themselves. And they can be a little bit reductive, but I think if someone were starting to build a narrative, whether they're writing a TV show or preparing for trial, to come back to really those essentials, like, what kind of story is this? Is this a trial about the man versus the machine, like taking over a corporation? Or is it a voyage and return, someone leaving and returning home to find that they have changed or encountered change in the place that they came from? And I find those principles to be really useful. I also love looking at log lines and taglines for TV shows and films, because they do a great job at not only selling a project, but getting the thesis down of what is the big story. For instance, Breaking Bad. What was the pitch for Breaking Bad? How does Mr. Chips become Scarface? How does a high school chemistry teacher turn into a drug kingpin? And you know right away that over five seasons, actually two TV shows and feature films, that is the fundamental question that they're asking.
So you mentioned log lines and taglines. Can you tell us what you mean by those?
Log lines and taglines are often the short sentence that you'll see on movie posters. Sometimes they're short. They're could be public facing, or in the industry, they are the elevator pitch, or the shortest, most succinct way that you're pitching your story. Breaking Bad has a very elegant one. How does Mr. Chips become Scarface? But there are many examples of this.
So are they exactly the same thing? They're just interchangeable terms?
Yeah, the log line is usually a longer sentence, and that kind of tells the story. And a tagline is the phrase that goes under the title. Like, one of my favorites is For My Cousin Vinny, a comedy of trial and error, or The First Wives Club, Don't Get Mad, Get Everything, or Wicked has a great one, Wicked the Musical, A Lot Happened Before Dorothy Dropped In. So right away, you're telling the audience what kind of story they're about to see.
Yeah, they can be pretty exciting, that's for sure. So you mentioned, Kevin, that there are all of these different man versus whatever, like man versus man, man versus the machine, man versus nature. In a trial or in a legal conflict, it seems like everything would ultimately be man versus man. So how do lawyers determine which is actually the correct conflict that applies to their case if it's not strictly man versus man?
That's a good question. I think the details of someone's life story, I would imagine, adds so much to a compelling trial narrative. So you look at rags to riches, the kind of Cinderella fairy tale stories. Is this a story of someone who grew up in extreme poverty and then became a billionaire and stole everyone's money? Or is this someone that started at the top of the food chain, running a giant organization, and then lost everything? And what were the events that led to that trajectory? Because everybody's story has ups and downs and peaks and valleys, and has a beginning and a middle and an end. And what is the rising action of a story? Because a good story, again, has suspense to it. It's surprising and inevitable. You don't want to go see a piece of theater or read a book that's boring. I wouldn't want to go and, I've been on jury duty. I don't want to sit through a trial that is boring. I don't want to be entertained, but I want it to be a compelling narrative. And then it's also hitting those themes, right? We've all seen it used to dire effect and on Twitter and in the political sphere. But how do you hit the theme and the question throughout the trial that is almost Pavlovian, that you're reminding people what the big essence of your story is? And that's what we do in every show that we do, with costumes, with lighting. What's the color palette? Not that there's a scenography in the courtroom, but if there were, what would it look like? That's what I would ask a lawyer. What would your set design look like if you were telling this story on stage?
It's a great question. Those things all transmit a certain message, or they reinforce the message that you are actually delivering.
Yeah.
Great point.
Imagine the redwood forest on a dark night, or a trailer park with a giant meth problem, like whatever. Those are two very random examples, but you're painting a picture. You're somehow I'm stuck on meth because we're talking about Breaking Bad, but you know, there's a lot of trials about drugs, I guess.
It also makes me think about character building and world building. That's a big part of what we do. You know, that's sort of what Kevin's speaking to in terms of atmosphere and set. And a lot of our work is about using all of the senses in our work. So, you know, lighting and costume textures and using language to really create a world that audience members can step into and be fully immersed in. And I imagine trial lawyers, even Kevin's opening sentence just then, trial lawyers might be able to use setting the stage or evoking an atmosphere to great effect, or using character development language to tell a heartbreaking or infuriating story about their client. So I think that's also part of storytelling as well.
You mentioned themes. And I wonder if there are actually universal themes that kind of resonate across demographics, because that's your jury right there. Demographics, a huge mix of men and women, young and old, racially and culturally diverse, and different education levels and different life experiences, and on and on and on. So it seems like there might be a challenge in trying to find kind of a unifying theme that everybody can relate to. But surely there are. And I wonder if you could talk about what some of those themes would be that we all can relate to, no matter who we are and where we came from.
I think Kevin spoke to some of them earlier in terms of that wonderful anthropologist who studies stories. I think any anthropologist who studies the building blocks of storytelling, and there are many of them, you know, Joseph Campbell to name one, about these elemental building blocks that seem to cross cultures, cross languages, cross all kinds of divides. And those would be really fascinating to weave into a lawyer's practice or study of storytelling, I think.
There's a wonderful article by Adam Gopnik in this week's New Yorker, and it's his review of this new oral history about Hollywood, and he breaks it down to these mythological archetypes of these, you know, characters and movie moguls and movie stars. And going back to mythology, I think, is really helpful. Icarus flew too close to the sun. What is that metaphor of flying too high, being overconfident and burning brightly because you got too close to the sun? That's a very universal human experience. The need and the desire to be loved, to be recognized for who you are, whether you're running a mega church or you're Liza Minnelli at Carnegie Hall or you're a lonely, you know, schoolboy, whatever it might be. I don't know why those three references just came out of my mouth. That's very random. But that is like that, the need to be loved, the need to connect and to believe in something. I mean, my favorite philosopher and writer and thinker is Yuval Noah Harari, and his book Sapiens changed my life. I would recommend that every lawyer and every thinker read Sapiens. And Yuval Noah Harari's main thesis is that humans, Homo sapiens, have taken over the planet because we're the only species on Earth that can cooperate flexibly in large numbers and believe in things that we cannot see. And you think of the things that we've all agreed to believe in as humans. One of his examples is limited liability companies, right? Like, what is a limited liability company? I've got three of them, but I still try to understand what that even means, right? The religions that we believe, that we agree to believe in, the borders, like, what is a border? We've made up these borders. And all of these things exist to help us make sense of the world around us. And so I think going back to the systems and structures that we agree to believe in, and then where those systems and structures have broken down, could be a really useful way into a trial narrative.
I think that's a fascinating idea. Kate, I would like to talk to you a little bit about your forte, which I know is creativity. Where should we look for inspiration to develop the stories that we as lawyers must tell about our clients? I'm wondering if there are things that we could do as a regular or maybe daily practice that would nourish our creativity so that we see our cases differently and more expansively, to kind of make those connections that Kevin was talking about, like maybe seeing a character in the case as an Icarus type.
One of the most important parts of my practice is taking in as much material as possible, whether that's television or books or theater or truly any media or any stories. I think the more stories you read and watch and experience, the broader your vocabulary can be in terms of the possibilities for storytelling. And as a trial lawyer who's often working with true stories, nonfiction, I imagine that reading more nonfiction material or listening to podcasts based on nonfiction material might be particularly inspiring to see how people have adapted and retold true events.
That's a great idea. What about you, Kevin? Do you have thoughts on how to nourish the creative soul?
I always think of our jobs as creatives, as theater makers and filmmakers, as being an ongoing liberal arts education. Like Kate and I get to constantly learn about so many different time periods and design styles and narratives. And I think anyone who wants to pursue a creative practice, whether it's in the arts or becoming a more creative storytelling in the courtroom, I think that omnivorous taste for as much material as you can get your hands on, as Kate was saying, I listen to NPR all day long in the background as I'm working, because I always get introduced to ideas and books and stories that I haven't even ever heard of. And constantly broadening your horizons, I read the New York Times every day, I read the op-eds, I sometimes dip into the fake news sites and see what the other side is talking about, because I think it's important to know what those narratives are. And having really interesting dinner party guests, having conversations. When we come down to these conferences, it's always so much fun to sit around the table with these incredible lawyers and judges and hear all of their stories. I love to ask all of them, what's the wildest, strangest case that you've had this year? And every single one of them is like, well, that's a good idea for a TV show. Well, that should be a movie. And I find that a lot of lawyers and judges are good storytellers when they're recounting the adventures of, you know, of something they just went through. And I want to go back to the elevator pitch, because it's a very big part of our industry. And explaining what that is quite literally, I think, is helpful. That if you can't boil your idea down to one elevator ride, then the idea probably isn't going to sell, whether it's to a TV network or to a jury. And so if you're on an elevator and Steven Spielberg walks in, we should all be so lucky, and he says, so, Kate, what are you working on? Then if you're like, well, I'm kind of working on this show that, so it's based on a book, and already you've lost him, right? And so practice that elevator pitch. I would encourage everyone to digest lots of material and try it out on people. Rehearse it. So like you're always coming down to this compelling story. And if you can't do it in one elevator ride, you're probably not going to win that trial.
I learned a new term when I was preparing to speak to both of you, and that is dramaturge. What exactly is dramaturge? And also, did I pronounce it correctly?
Dramaturg. And yes, who practices dramaturgy.
Okay. So what is it?
Dramaturgs are the unsung heroes of theater. They are not only supporting a production, often in terms of how a script is structured and maintaining the aesthetic unity of a production and the historical authenticity of a production. They're sort of everywhere. How would you describe it, Kevin? I have worked with dramaturgs who are asking me provocative questions about, you know, not just plot points and character choices, but also, as I mentioned, you know, providing information about the time period in which I'm writing, which I may not have known about.
Yes, we're working on a wonderful project that our friend Dom is producing called The Survival of St. Joan. And we've set the piece in 1969 in Buffalo, New York. And our amazing dramaturg on the project, her name is Jay. And Jay would just bring all of these interesting questions and research to the table, not only about factual things that were happening in that time and place, but the big ideas. What were the questions that were being asked? And to give a very concrete example, Jay discovered in her research that there were these social clubs where young people would hang out. And immediately, Kate just ran with that idea with the book of what if all of these kids from different backgrounds, teenagers, were meeting at one social club, and the intersection of all the movements that were happening in that time were occurring in this one place. And so something like that, can you never know where that nugget's going to come from. And part of our approach as theater makers and artists is, you know, I believe the best idea wins. And our job is to create an environment where everyone can be creative and vulnerable and bring their ideas to the table. And Kate's particularly good at this. Of all the writers that I've worked with, Kate takes in all of the questions and information and then immediately turns it into playable dialogue in a rich story for the stage. And dramaturgs are a big part of that.
They almost sound a little bit like, the term is escaping me, but on a film, they are an editor who makes sure that all of the pieces fit together and that things come in the right order. Little things that kind of seem bloopery if they're left in. And am I kind of heading in the right direction with what a dramaturg is?
Yes, they're that. And they're also master researchers. So they're script supervisors and everywhere. They're everywhere all at once.
So they're making sure that all the pieces of the universe fit together.
Yes, that's a great way of saying it. It's very elegant way.
So what can lawyers take away from knowing about the art, or I don't know, is it a science of dramaturgy?
I suppose lawyers in a sense are also functioning as dramaturgs in a sense in their research capacity. And as Kevin has so succinctly put, making sure that the story that they're telling is cohesive and makes sense. So at once lawyers seem to be dramaturgs, but also playwrights, but also directors. So they're really a one-stop shop there.
And I think studying TV is really helpful. I love to go back and watch a season of a show that I loved growing up or that I watched a few years ago and study how they did it. I love to go watch the pilot of one of my favorite shows and then the season finale and then maybe the finale of the entire show, right? Because if you're a trial lawyer, and let's say I'll just make up an example, it's a 2-week trial and every day you're delivering kind of like an episode in a series. And what is that cliffhanger or that suspenseful, again, surprising and inevitable thing that you end on each day that encourages the jury to, I guess they have to come back, they're forced to be there, right? But to want to come back the next day and see how the story ends and to see what the next step might be and to really weave a narrative that's compelling. I mean, a good story has to be compelling. And again, everyone has to be telling the same story. So looking at all of the facts and the details and making sure they add up to a consistent narrative is what a dramaturg does and what a script supervisor does in television, making sure there's continuity, that there's no Starbucks cup in the Game of Thrones court. I guess that's a good metaphor for storytelling and for visual storytelling. Make sure you don't have a Starbucks cup in your Game of Thrones shot.
Well, and I love the idea of thinking to yourself about each day that you're in trial is an episode of a series, and that you always want to end on a cliffhanger and leave them asking for more. So I had your friend David Mann on the podcast last summer, and we had a really fun talk about some of these same issues about persuasive storytelling. And I asked him a question that I now would love to ask both of you as well, because frankly, it's an issue that will never go away. How do you tell the story of an unsympathetic client, someone who has done something so hideous and reprehensible that they're basically impossible to root for? Kevin, I'll ask you first.
Oh, isn't that such a great question? I mean, the only analogy I can think of is directing a show that has a strong villain in it, that if I'm directing the opera about Anne Boleyn, for instance, right? Like Henry VIII does not come off very well in that story, in history and in the opera, but you still have to want to watch him and listen to him sing for 3 hours. So how do you get down to the psychology of a character that makes them compelling even when they're doing terrible things, like beheading their wife, right? Beheading his wife. I mean, that's, everyone knows how that story is going to end. And same in a trial. Let's say you're doing a murder trial. Everyone in the jury is going to know that how the story ends, with somebody dying, getting killed, and then looking at the details that went into it. So I always try to, and Kate can speak more to this because you're the actress. I mean, you're the performer. You've played some dark characters and some comedic characters, all of it. Kate and I did a show, we're working on a show called The Ninth Hour that looks at the duality of good and evil and how they need each other. And so I don't know how I would do it in a trial. I mean, we're not lawyers, of course, but I think trying to build as much of a backstory to really get into the psychology of maybe how this person ended up where they are, what are the things that a jury could latch on to about a tough upbringing? I mean, I don't know. I've never had to defend an unsympathetic criminal before. So I don't know. Kate, what do you think?
Yeah, it's a fascinating moral question. I think if put in that position, I might be drawing on themes and questions that are larger than my client. Sort of as you said, I would be thinking about the forces that led these people to these choices rather than focusing on whether or not you'd like to have this person over to your house for dinner or not. I'd be thinking about the systemic structures in our society that might lead someone to make these choices, or rather how systems in our society have led someone without a choice in some senses. I would be thinking about, you know, why the lawyer is there in the first place, because we have a legal system here in which everyone deserves a right to a trial, and outlining again the terms of that and reasonable doubt. I think I would be looking at, I would be zooming out in those situations.
I know that you both are really busy with your theater productions, which is writing and rehearsals and travel and everything else that goes into it, but you're not lawyers, obviously. So I want to ask, why do you teach for NIDA and how do you help lawyers?
I was really interested when I first came down to teach. I didn't realize that most lawyers are not taught how to try a case in law school. That blew my mind. I thought that must be part of the training, even though I have a lot of lawyer friends. It just never came up in conversation because, of course, a lot of cases don't go to trial. They're settled in mediation or plea bargains, of course. And so the fact that storytelling and trial strategy is not part of a lawyer's education typically is the reason why NIDA exists and why it's been so successful. And I just love that, because the things that come very naturally to Kate and I as storytellers and artists that we've been studying and practicing our whole lives and careers and continue to learn to be better at it. Like, our job is to get up every day and learn how to be better storytellers, better communicators, how to have, you know, captivate an audience. I mean, when I look at my job is literally to gather a group of people, harness their energy in a room to make sure they're all telling the same story, to then get an audience of hundreds, thousands, hopefully millions on television to laugh and cry on cue, to gasp on cue, to be surprised. And there are many ways to build a story. And that's something that we talk about all day long. Kate and I have had a couple of meetings very recently about stories that we're working on, how to make those stories stronger. We just had a workshop where we dove really deep into these characters and stories and always fine tuning. And when we started teaching, the response of all of the lawyers was people just seemed to really like hearing us talk. And I love it when Kate talks about the structure of a pop song. I think that is so helpful. Like every song has like a verse, a chorus, a bridge that takes you to the repeat of the chorus. I think a pop song could apply to any story structure for a trial, right? What are the themes that you're repeating? What's your chorus? What's that surprising bridge that brings you back to your chorus? And we just love talking about this stuff and sharing. And again, ongoing liberal arts education, we love to learn. So every time I spend time with these lawyers, that I learn so much. I learn from their questions. And when we all get to have dinner and have coffee together, we're sharing our perspectives from different disciplines and learning from each other. And that's just the kind of thing that I live for.
Yeah, same. I think I like Kevin, I'm a naturally curious person. So any excuse to sit with many people who are in a profession that if I had another 24 hours attached to every day that is already 24 hours, I would definitely be going to law school and trying to take cases to trial. But I think that's really the heart of it. I'm just so curious about this work, and the work that lawyers do truly shapes culture and policy in a way that artists do as well. So I think the work is important in any, I think there's a lot of synergistic crossover between how we're working and how we can be more efficient and how we can be ethical and aligned in our practices.
Yeah, it's a really multidisciplinary way of looking at a legal case.
And I also love watching Dom and all of his colleagues teach. I mean, Dom is an incredible storyteller, and everyone on his staff tells great stories. They're great teachers. They pose moral and philosophical and strategic questions. So when Kate and I go down, we, do our lecture in class for an hour and then get to stick around all day and hear the other classes. And I love attending the conversations about body language. And like, I love to have this exercise where I try to get every single person in the class to look me deeply in the eye by the time we're done talking, because I know this is a podcast and you can't see my body language, but some people don't make a lot of eye contact and they're kind of inside themselves. And how do you get everyone in the room? And then after you do that, you say, you see what I just did? Now you're all looking me directly in the eye, and I can probably persuade you of something just by my body language. And then the lawyers are like, wow, that's so interesting. You're right. I am looking you in the eye. And it's almost like we're demonstrating the craft of what we do just by being there.
Yeah, it's just fascinating that if you get out of your bubble as a lawyer, you can really transform your case, and it makes all the difference in the world. And I mean, it's true for all of us. You just never know where that inspiration is going to come from or where it's going to take you. I'm sure you're both wonderful to watch. I wish that I could come and attend the program myself. I love going to the programs too and meeting the people. And it's a powerful experience to be there on the first day and watch people as they're filing in and they're kind of tentative and nervous, like, oh my God, what have I gotten myself into? And they're worried about having to perform in front of other people and learning new skills. And then by day six, the trial day, it's like totally different people.
The most moving thing that happened, I'm very open about who I am, about being a queer artist. And I met this lawyer, and we had a conversation and over coffee on the break, and he really enjoyed our presentation. And I got a letter from him a couple of weeks later saying that he had decided to come out to his colleagues and to be open at work because of seeing our presentation, and the fact that I was so open about who I am empowered him to actually be open about who he is at work and with his colleagues. And I was just so moved by that. You can never know how you're going to touch someone's life, not only as a teacher, but just as a, wild New York artist.
That is an amazing story. Got it. That's just fantastic.
It's pretty special.
Well, thank you for doing that. That's great. I mean, one of the things that we talk about at NIDA is that it's so important to have mentors and to be able to hoist yourself up on the shoulders of giants. And I think that maybe you're a giant. So,
no, it's great. Thank you. That's very, very kind.
Well, I've got a different sign-off question than usual, and it seems to fit well with the stuff that we've been talking about, which is cultivating inspiration from wherever you happen to find it. So, Kate, I want to ask you, what TV shows have you been binge-watching recently, or what movies have you watched that have inspired you?
I will speak to TV that I've been watching recently. I am watching White Lotus, along with It Feels Like Everyone Else. So no spoilers, I'm not caught up, Kevin.
I am obsessed with White Lotus. It is so incredible.
Which is an incredible dissection of many. I don't want to spoil anything, but I also, speaking of trials, I have also finished the second season of the television show The Vow, which I don't know if you've heard of it, but basically follows the experiences of people who were involved in this self-improvement group called Nexium. And eventually the head of this organization charges of sex trafficking and racketeering and conspiracy were brought against its founder, Keith Raniere. And the show is thrilling. Cannot recommend it enough. I think it is. It's not just about this case. It's about duality in all of our lives and how the compromises we make on a micro level in the day-to-day. Everyone should watch it. It's required viewing.
And I want to chime in. I have not watched The Vow yet, but I can't wait to watch it. But the new season of White Lotus is extraordinary television. And in fact, it airs every Sunday on HBO, and the finale is next week. And I've been watching it in sequence. So in a way, it's kind of the opposite of binge watching. I have been running home on Sunday nights as soon as it's on HBO Max. I can't get enough of it. And we're not giving very much away to say that it starts with a murder. Like each season is a self-contained story, and there's a body that appears somewhere, and the whole narrative is like, well, who's going to die and how did it happen? And the way that Mike White, the creator and writer and director of the show, weaves all of these narratives together, and also a really good example of unsympathetic characters that you really fall in love with, right? Like, what is it that makes us root for a Walter White or a Tony Soprano, even though they're doing terrible, terrible things? And the White Lotus is filled with characters with, let's say, morally questionable judgment. And watching those stories intersect, I feel like I'm learning about human nature. It's the kind of show that I wish that I would have made. I think it's so, I would have been proud to make. I think it's so wonderful. I also really love The Bear, a show about a restaurant, a working class neighborhood in Chicago. I think that's also a really interesting show because there are some unsympathetic characters on that show, but you really care about them, and it's about chosen family and about work-life balance, and it really tells a compelling story.
Thank you so much. It sounds like we all finally have an excuse to binge watch on Netflix and not feel too badly about it. So I appreciate you bringing that inspiration to us.
And I encourage the lawyers to take notes when you're watching a show. Do approach it the way Kate and I do. Like, what are the story structures? Why is it working? What? Wow, I didn't see that coming. And then watch an episode twice. If you see an episode that had you on the edge of your seat, watch it a second time. Find the screenplay online and read it and study the structure of how they built that story. I think that's advice I would definitely pass on to, not just rereading your favorite books, but watch your favorite episodes and movies and study how they told the story.
Perfect. Thank you so much.
Thanks for having us. Yeah.
Thank you. It's been so wonderful chatting with you.
You may have noticed the name Dom mentioned a couple of times in this episode. And in case you're wondering who that is, it's none other than Dominic Gianna, who was a guest of the podcast last year.
He too joined us to talk about storytelling. He believes that the story you tell about your client at trial is absolutely everything. As the program director of our New Orleans deposition and trial courses, he brings in nationally renowned storytellers like Kevin Newberry, Kate Douglas, and David Mann to serve as his faculty members. So if you would like to refine your skills in a fun place like the Big Easy in April, please look for the link in today's show notes. Dom and Kevin and Kate and David would all love to see you there and to help you make your case with the best story possible. Thank you so much for listening, everyone. I will catch you in the next episode.
May the Record Reflect is a NIDA Studio 71 production. NIDA, we are advocacy enhanced, mentorship reimagined. Welcome to the community.